a person whose essential being is awakened. The word used to mean junior Buddha, someone on the way to becoming a Buddha. But in the course of time, it came to mean someone who had attained Buddhahood, who had reached nirvana, but who returns into everyday life to deliver all other beings. This is the popular idea of a bodhisattva, a savior. And so in the popular Buddhism of Tibet and China and Japan, people worship the bodhisattvas, the great bodhisattvas, as saviors. Say the hermaphroditic Kuan Yin. People love Kuan Yin because she could be a Buddha, but has come back into the world to save all beings. The Japanese call he/she Kanon. And they have in Kyoto an image of Kanon with 1,000 arms, radiating like a great aureole all round this great golden figure. And these 1,000 arms are 1,000 different ways of rescuing beings from ignorance. Kanon is a funny thing. I remember one night when I suddenly realized that Kanon was incarnate in the whole city of Kyoto. That this whole city was Kanon. That the police department, the taxi drivers, the fire department, the mayor and corporation, the shopkeepers, insofar as this whole city was a collaborative effort to sustain human life, however bumbling, however inefficient, however corrupt, it was still a manifestation of Kanon, with its 1,000 arms, all working independently, and yet one. So they revere those bodhisattvas as the saviors who've come back into the world to deliver all beings. But there is a more esoteric interpretation of this. The bodhisattva returns into the world. That means he has discovered that you don't have to go anywhere to find nirvana. Nirvana is where you are, provided you don't object to it. Change, and everything is change, nothing can be held on to. To the degree that you go with a stream, you see, you are still. You're flowing with it. But to the degree you resist the stream, then you notice that the current is rushing past you and fighting with you. So swim with it. Go with it. And you're there. You're at rest. And this is, of course, particularly true when it comes to those moments when life really seems to be going to take us away. And the stream of change is going to swallow us completely. The moment of death. And we think, this is it. This is the end. And so at death we withdraw. Say, no, not that. Not yet, please. But actually, the whole problem is that there really is no other problem for human beings than to go over that waterfall when it comes. Just as you go over any other waterfall. Just as you go on from day to day. Just as you go to sleep at night. Be absolutely willing to die. Now, I'm not preaching. I'm not saying you ought to be willing to die and that you should muscle up your courage and somehow put on a good front when the terrible thing comes. That's not the idea at all. Point is that you can only die well if you understand this system of waves. If you understand that your disappearance as the form in which you think you are you, your disappearance as this particular organism, is simply seasonal, that you are just as much the dark space beyond death as you are the light interval called life. These are just two sides of you, because you is the total wave. See, you can't have half a wave. Nobody ever saw waves which just had crests, no troughs. So you can't have half a human being who is born but doesn't die. Half a thing. That would be only half a thing. But the propagation of vibrations, and life is vibration, it simply goes on and on, but its cycles are long cycles and short cycles. Space, you see, is not just nothing. If I could magnify my hand to an enormous degree so that you could see all the molecules in it, I don't know how far apart they would be, but it seems to me they would be something like tennis balls in a very, very large space. And you'd look, when I move my hand like this, and say, for God's sake, look at all those tennis balls. They're all going together. Crazy. And there are no strings tying them together. Isn't that queer? No, but there's space going with them. And space is a function of, or it's an inseparable aspect of, whatever solids are in the space. That is the clue, probably, to what we mean by gravity. We don't know yet. So in the same way, when those marvelous sandpipers come around here, the little ones, while they're in the air flying, they have one mind. They move all together. When they alight on the mud, they become individuals and they go picking around for worms or something. But one click of the fingers and all those things are going zipped into the air. They don't seem to have a leader, because they don't follow when they turn. They all turn together and go off in another direction. Amazing. But they're like the molecules in my hand. So then you see, here's the principle. When you don't resist change, I mean over-resist, I don't mean being flabby. When you don't resist change, you see that the changing world, which disappears like smoke, is no different from the nirvana world. Nirvana, as I said, means breathe out. Let go of the breath. So in the same way, don't resist change. It's all the same principle. So the bodhisattva saves all beings, not by preaching sermons to them, but by showing them that they are delivered, they are liberated, by the very fact of not being able to stop changing. You can't hang on to yourself. You don't have to try not to hang on to yourself. It can't be done. And that is salvation. Memento mori, be mindful of death. Gurdjieff says in one of his books that the most important thing for anyone to realize is that you and all you, every person you see, will soon be dead. See, it sounds so gloomy to us, because we have devised a culture fundamentally resisting death. I love the story of a conversation at an English country house at a dinner party, where the hostess started up the question of death and asked the various guests what they thought was going to happen to them when they die. And some thought about reincarnation, and others thought about various kinds of different planes of being, and others thought they were going to be annihilated. But none of the guests had answered except Sir Roderick, who was a kind of a military type, but a very devout pillar of the Church of England. He was the church warden, chief of the vestry in the local country parish. And the lady said, "Sir Roderick, you haven't said a word. What do you think is going to happen to you when you die?" "Oh," he said, "I am perfectly certain that I shall go to heaven and enjoy everlasting bliss, but I wish you wouldn't indulge in such a depressing conversation." It's true, isn't it? Death in the Western world is a real problem. We hush it up. We pretend it hasn't happened. Our morticians, who are very smart commercial operators, know exactly what's expected of them. And they make death just awful by pretending it doesn't happen. See what happens. You go to a hospital and you're at the end. You've got terminal cancer. And all your friends come around and they wear false smiles and they say, "Cheer up, you'll be all right. In a few days from now, you'll be back home and we'll go out for a picnic again." The doctors have their bedside manner. You see, a doctor is absolutely helpless with a terminal case because doctors are, by social definition, a healer. And he's not allowed to help you die. He's out of role. Even though, I mean, he may sneak behind the rules and do it, but he's got to heal you. So he's going to keep you indefinitely on the end of tubes and all kinds of things. While there's a certain grave demeanor to all this, and all the nurses are so pleasant and so totally distant because they know this is death. And they mayn't be frank with you. That's why they feel distant. It's not that they're not concerned. It's not that they're heartless people. But that they just don't know how to be frank, like lots of people when they meet a drunk. They don't know what to do with a drunk. Because he's not behaving right. And so, when you're dying, you're not behaving right. You're supposed to live. See, so we don't know what to do with a dying person. We don't get around that person and say, listen, I've got the news for you. You're going to die. And this is going to be great. Look, no more responsibilities. Don't have to pay those bills anymore. Don't have to worry about anything. You're going to just die. And let's go out with a bang. Let's have a party, see? We'll put some of that morphine in you so that you won't hurt too much. But we were going to prop you up in bed, and we're going to bring all our friends around, and we're going to have champagne, and you're going to die at the end of it, see? And it's going to be just marvelous. Just like being born, see? When we had birth problems, see, all women used to think that birth had to be painful. It was good for them. It was one of the things you had to suffer because you'd been screwing around with people, and therefore you had to have a child, and it's got to hurt. And then the doctors got together and they scratched their heads, and the man called Grantly Dick Reed said, "No, birth doesn't hurt, it's natural." All we've got to do is to talk these women into the idea that it doesn't hurt, that all these so-called pains are just tensions, and that birth is great. It's not a disease. It's not really something you ought to go to hospital for, because you associate hospitals with diseases and sickness. Birth isn't sickness. All right, now let's do some new thinking. What about death? Is death sickness? Or is it a healthy, natural event like being born? Of course it is. So, I mean, a little change in social attitude about this will fortify everybody else. I mean, if I'm alone and all my relatives are going, and kind of pretending to me, it's going to be hard for me. I've got to challenge the whole bunch of them and get my dander up and say, listen, damn you, I don't want all this thing around here. You've got to take a different attitude about my death. Well, that's hard. But if everybody helps me, and we do, we're all one body, if they all come around and say, congratulations, you're going to die. Liberation. Liberation now, you see. Because just before you die, I mean, look, I know very well a skillful priest handling a person dying can do this for them. But he has to talk very, very, very straight. And he has to say, listen, these doctors, don't you pay any attention to them. They're trying to amuse you and deceive you. You're going to die. This isn't terrible. But it's just going to be the end of you as a system of memories. And so you've got a great chance right now, before it happens, to let go of everything. Because you know it's going to go, and it is going to help you. It's going to help you let go of everything. So if you have any possessions left, give them away. Give everything away. And if you have anything to say that is you felt that you ought to say before you die, and that you're kind of hanging on to and it's bothering you, say it. I mean, I don't mean necessarily a last confession, but say it said that Adlai Stevenson, shortly before he died, said that he had been making a monkey of himself because he didn't agree with the government's policy about something or other. You know, he had to get that off his chest because he had a little thought in the back of his mind that things were catching up with him, you see? So the moment comes when this thing called death has to be taken completely, not as some ghastly accident, something that all your friends are going to stay away because you're awful. I mean, sometimes people, when they die, are in a very unpleasant physical condition. They don't smell good, they don't look good, and so on. But an enormous amount can be done with scientific methods to make things reasonably tidy from a purely sensory point of view. But the main thing is the attitude that death is as positive as birth and should be a matter for rejoicing, because death is the symbol of the liberation. There is a wonderful saying that Ananda Kumaraswamy used to quote, I pray that death will not come and find me still unannihilate. In other words, that man dies happy if there is no one to die. In other words, if the ego has disappeared before death caught up with it. But you see, the knowledge of death helps the ego to disappear, because it tells you you can't hang on. So what we need, if we're going to have a good religion around, that's one of the places where it can start. Having, I don't know, well, nowadays I suppose they'd call it the Institution for Creative Dying. But something like that. And you can have one department where you can have champagne cocktail party to die with, another department where you can have glorious religious rituals and priests and things like that, another department where you can have psychedelic drugs, another department where you can have special kinds of music, anything, you know. All these arrangements will be provided for in a hospital for delightful dying. But that's the thing, to go out with a bang instead of a whimper.
Out of Your Mind now continues with the next lecture from the World as Emptiness lecture series.
I was talking a great deal yesterday afternoon about the Buddhist attitude to change, to death, to the transience of the world, and was showing that preachers of all kinds